This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Many thousands of visitors will be in New York City next week for the Republican National Convention. Hordes of delegates, reporters, and protesters. City officials hope that they will crowd into every restaurant, coffee shop, and bar between Broadway and the East Village. Leaving the politics and the rhetoric aside, the convention should be big business for the Big Apple. That at least is what we're told when mayors throw elbows in the fierce competition to attract major events like political conventions or the Olympic Games. Cities beg their residents to put up with short-term hassles in the name of economic windfall and a lasting boon to tourism. But how real are those benefits? The city of Boston now estimates it turned a $15 million profit from the Democratic National Convention, more than $100 million less than some officials predicted, though, to be fair, that number is still a lot bigger than critics projected. And how much did the Olympics contribute to the prosperity of Los Angeles, Atlanta, or Salt Lake City? Later in the program, why Iraqis risk their lives to bury their loved ones in the embattled city of Najaf, and a commission that investigated the Abu Ghraib prison scandal releases its report at the Pentagon today. But we focus this hour on how major events affect the economies of their host cities, short-term and long. Which businesses benefit, which are hurt? How far through the local economy does that windfall spread? And how do you measure intangible benefits against the bottom line? We want to hear from all of you during the course of the show, and especially from those of you listening to WBUR in Boston. You're on the front lines of this story right now. If you live or do business in Boston, was the Democratic Convention worth it? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now from Texas Public Radio in San Antonio is Heyward Sanders, an economics professor at the University of Texas in San Antonio. He studies the economics of big events like these. Good of you to join us today.
Nice to join you, Neil.
These events always come heralded by enormous projected earnings for the host city. Both Boston and New York projected windfalls in the hundreds of millions of dollars range. Does reality ever live up to those projections?
Not very often. What we're talking about is a process by which selling these kinds of events to cities is typically accompanied by enormous promises of economic impact. Mayor Menino's staff in Boston generated an estimate of $154 million in economic benefits before the convention. A more recent estimate from an independent institute at Suffolk University put the impact at closer to $15 million. Mm-hmm. That's about 10%. But I was just reading an editorial in the Boston Globe from about 2 weeks ago. Their term was that rosy estimates of economic impact became fantasy material. So essentially what we're looking at are numbers classically about these kinds of big events and typically about conventions and tourism generally that are enormously overinflated and not at all realistic.
So we can see why some people in a city might want to pick out the rosiest number possible to make an event happen. But in terms of what actually happens, if these things are so bad, why do mayors keep fighting for them?
Well, we have to look at the two sides of the coin here. One piece of it is what the economic impact actually is. And as I said, it's typically relatively modest. But another piece of that is the kind of political symbolism, and particularly at the local level. If Mayor Menino won the race against Miami and New York to hold the DNC this year, that's quite a feather in his cap, and at least it appeared that way early on. For big city mayors who are often caught between limited tax revenues and demands for services, and in the case of both Boston and New York, demands from city employees for higher wages and benefits, being able to win at this race can be a real plum symbolically, even if it doesn't amount to a whole lot of economic substance.
Mm-hmm. Do cities weigh up in their bids when they're making their bids to host these big events, whether it's the Olympics or a political convention? Do they do them rationally, or are they swept up in the excitement of putting on a major event?
Well, it typically is done with that kind of excitement, that kind of promise that for some cities it's a coming of age, a putting your city on the map. It's certainly not clear for New York City that it needs to be put on the map as a world city. And I would argue much the same for Boston. But I remember when Mayor Ed Rendell, now Governor Rendell in Philadelphia, touted his winning of the Republican convention in 2000 as a kind of statement of Philadelphia's urban turnaround and its great success and coming of age. That may have been something that helped him win the governor's office in Harrisburg. But whether it did much for Philadelphia or not is open to question.
Well, we certainly want your input in all of this. Our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also email us, TOTN@NPR.org. Summer is on the line with us from Baltimore, Maryland.
Hello.
Hello.
I just wanted to say that I live in Boston, actually, and I left town for the convention because the freeway was shut down in my part of town, and they were predicting ridiculous traffic jams on the surface streets. And I just think that it could have been a boon for Boston, the convention, but it wasn't because the security was really completely overblown.
Mm-hmm. That's a big factor, Haywood Sanders. Since 9/11, it's always been a big factor. Since 9/11, a bigger factor.
Absolutely. I mean, we had a case in Boston where the principal venue for the convention, the Fleet Center, was basically taken up for most all of the summer, and that meant not having the kinds of regular events that it would normally have in order to prepare and get set up for the convention. The Secret Service insisted on a fairly broad area being secured around that center, and that naturally slowed up in Boston's case because the Fleet Center sits right at North Station, a major commuter rail hub, really slowed up much of the local economy.
And right next to I-93, the major north-south artery through the city.
Absolutely. And in fact, we're looking in New York at a convention, the principal venue of which will be at Madison Square Garden. It's right atop Penn Station. So I suspect we're going to see a very similar phenomenon there as well.
Summer, the convention ended a couple of weeks ago. I think it's safe to go home.
Thanks a lot. I just wanted to mention that I think you can always demand, an infinite level of security, which really can't be guaranteed under any circumstances.
Okay. Thanks very much for the phone call.
Thanks.
Haywood Sanders, I cut you off. What were you trying to say?
No, not at all. But it's also clear there's a downside to this. I mean, it's not just 9/11. Some folks will remember what happened in Chicago in 1968. Protests these days are part and parcel of a national political convention. And so in recent years, even before 9/11, security and accommodation for protesters has been a real problem. In a big city, particularly a dense developed one like Boston or New York, that means necessarily some real inconvenience.
Haywood Sanders, stay with us for a moment. Joining us now from Boston is Mayor Thomas Menino, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation again.
It's great to be with you.
To start with, I understand it's your first day back at work after a couple of days in the hospital. I hope you're feeling better.
I feel great. Real energy. I get a lot of energy right now.
Oh, good. Now, a tougher question. The economic windfall for the city of Boston from the Democratic National Convention, considerably less than projected. How come?
Well, that's everybody's projection. It's not the city's projection. It's not the Boston 2004. It's the Beacon Hill Institute, which has been against the convention since day one. I think a lot of business did well. But you don't gauge a convention by just those 4 days. You're talking about the previous weeks and months before and what happens afterwards, and also what happens in the future and the other conventions that come to Boston. When you look at the analysis that I look at, I think we did fairly well in that, the state did extremely well on new taxes coming into them. But you really gauge a convention about how many conventions come back to your city later on and people visit. And we just did a survey of delegates. Overwhelmingly, the delegates said that they're going to come back to Boston. Never been to Boston. They thought it was a great, lot of hospitality in the city that people loved, and they were going to come back here and bring their families here and bring their meetings to Boston. So I'm looking at the out years. And, you can't be narrow-minded and just look at this as a four-day event, because it isn't just a four-day event.
Well, some people look at the out years and look at the contract that was arrived at with the city's police and firefighters just before the convention. An arbitrator awarded them contracts rather larger than you had said the city was willing to accept.
That's correct. The arbitrator made that decision, but I said I'd take my chance with the arbitration decision, and I had to live with it. I mean, was I happy with it? Of course not, but the arbitrator made those decisions, and I was willing to hang in there, but the arbitrary to say that that was the number. And so I'm a man of my word, and I wish the union were able to work with us earlier on, but they didn't, weren't willing. And then we had to go to a joint labor management committee. They made those decisions for us. And, well, we got labor harmony right now, and we'll live with it. We live with the decision that's made by the arbitrator.
But the timing of the arbitration was dictated by the, well, nobody wanted to, the idea of Democratic politicians walking across picket lines. It couldn't happen.
Well, it couldn't happen. It should not happen. But also the unions would be unreasonable also. And, you know, they're trying to play chicken with us. And I was willing to hang out there and see what happened. And then finally at the end, an arbitrator came down with a decision with the fire union. It was the night before the convention started. With the police union, was 4 or 5 days previous to the convention starting. But, you know, you look at those things, you know, those aspects of it, that's, you know, a small, you know, it's an infinitesimal part of the whole thing. I'm looking at the benefits it had to Boston. I'm looking at the peace we had in the streets during the convention. We had 6 arrests during the whole convention. That says a lot about, says volumes about how the Boston Police knows how to work with diverse groups who come into our city.
If as you look at again what happened, there were a lot of projections about the some people do well, some people are not going to do well. But one of the things that really changed during this was the security. Did you anticipate all of the needs given where the Fleet Center is? How much of the city was going to have to be shut down?
And we never, you know, we got the convention before 9/11, so we didn't anticipate 9/11. No, we did, and now we'll all change. Since 9/11, security is the number one priority for all of us, and we worked. The Secret Service demanded we do certain things, and we did those certain things to make our city safe. And we'll continue to work with the public safety officials to make sure that the convention was safe. And I, you know, perhaps if something happened, they said, "Well, what is it?"
Mayor Menino's cell phone appears to be running out of a little battery problem, so if he comes back, we'll bring him back on. We'll give it just a second more to see if the cell phone is working. Evidently not. Well, if Mayor Menino gets back in touch, of course, we'll put him back on. Haywood Sanders, as you listen to what the mayor has to say, at least according to some of its most persistent critics, the city did turn a profit, much to their against their projection. So at least Boston, he sounds like he'd be happy to do it again.
Well, he even said before the convention that he'd like to have them back in 2008. As I said, it's a great piece of symbolic politics for the mayor. Presumably, he could be around in 2008 if he plays his political cards right. And aside from hoping a quick recuperation for him, I do agree that it certainly is the case. It will take a little while to really seriously assess the impact of the convention. We'll have to see how much hotel occupancy ended up rising for July and what kind of tax revenues there were. The mayor's notion that somehow thousands of folks are going to come back to Boston because they had a nice visit at the Democratic National Convention is open to some question if we take a look at the cities that have historically hosted major national political conventions and see how their convention and tourism business has done in the wake of those things. The result is not particularly heartening. Conventions don't come to your city just because you did a nice job for the Democrats or Republicans.
Excuse me. Mayor Menino is back on the line with us.
Sorry.
Mayor, excuse us. We just have a few seconds left. Wondered if you had any advice for Mayor Bloomberg, who's coming up next week.
Well, I say that Mayor Bloomberg, you know, every city is unique, but I would work with my public safety officials as best I can. Don't underestimate the demonstrations you might have in your city. We didn't, and, you know, it worked out well.
Mayor Menino is going to have to get a new cell phone, but we thank him for joining us today from Boston. We appreciate his time a great deal. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue talking about the economic and intangible benefits of major events that bring to their host cities. 800-989-8255. Have you been through a political convention or an Olympic Games where you live? I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the economics of hosting major events from political conventions to the Olympic Games. In a moment, we'll hear from a place that's trying to do both in under a decade, New York City. But now we want to hear from you, from people who felt the economic gains or losses of living in a city hosting a major event. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Our guest is Haywood Sanders, professor of economics at the University of Texas at San Antonio. And let's get a caller on the line. Brendan joins us from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
I wanted to contrast my two experiences. I actually lived in Salt Lake during the Olympics, and then I spent the summer in Boston. I was very impressed in Salt Lake with how they organized before the games. They really leveraged mass transit and set up these elaborate busing systems to shuttle the massive overflow of people in between the various Olympic events in different cities. Whereas in Boston, I mean, I live right near the Fleet Center, and I work about 20 miles outside the city, and so 93 is really my only route in between home and work. They shut down 15 miles of 93, 7 miles on either side of the convention. And not only that, but they shut down a lot of the mass transit in the city as well for security concerns. I just really felt that Salt Lake handled it extremely well, where Boston has a lot to learn about the balance between catering to the convention and inconveniencing the people who live in the city.
Haywood Sanders, traffic in Boston during the Democratic Convention was compared at one point to a Christmas morning.
Well, a lot of folks that I know who were in Boston simply chose not to go to work, and some folks recognized that for about a week they were going to get very little done, given the fairly complex commuting patterns in Boston, as well as its reliance on a very dense mass transit network. You know, it may come to the point where we recognize that we probably ought to put these conventions in a place somewhere out in the middle of nowhere more conveniently, as long as there are tens of thousands of hotel rooms available.
But there lies the rub, yeah.
Indeed. And it, frankly, that's part of the problem in assessing economic impact of these things. A community like Boston has a peak tourist season in its summer. And so even if you do get 25, 30, or 35,000 visitors for the convention itself, you're in all likelihood displacing a pretty substantial number of folks who would have been in that community anyway. Mm-hmm. And that kind of phenomenon is typically not really netted out by the local boosters and public officials who want to make the convention deal work and want to sell this to their community and to the respective political parties.
What about Brendan's point on Salt Lake City, though? The city did use the occasion of the Olympics to leverage a lot of mass transit projects, among other things.
That's true. And in fact, for the Olympics, the dynamic has tended to be a little different. After the Los Angeles Olympics, and particularly in the case of Atlanta, and we're seeing exactly the same thing in Athens, the Olympics become a vehicle for mounting enormous public capital investment. Typically additions to the mass transit system, in the case of Atlanta, a brand new stadium, an Olympic Village that has since been turned into dormitories for Georgia Tech. So you have a whole host of new public investment that happens, and much of that comes out of the economic impact of the television and broadcast revenues that the Olympics themselves generate. The national conventions, Super Bowl, typically don't produce that kind of impact. So for a lot of cities, the Olympics become literally a vehicle to mount really massive public investment. And that leaves a physical, a concrete product afterwards that can make a difference. Sadly, in the case of Atlanta, those products like Centennial Olympic Park are there. But it's not clear that it made any long-term difference to the city's convention business or to tourism generally. And that's the downside.
Brendan, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Joining us now from his office in Manhattan is Alexander Garvin, Managing Director for Planning, Design, and Development for New York City 2012. That's the group that oversees New York City's bid to host the 2012 Summer Olympic Games. Good of you to join us today.
My pleasure.
New York 2012 has put forward some pretty ambitious development plans. Give us a quick idea of what you're proposing.
We're proposing to create A, an Olympic X around which the entire Olympics would be held. The center of the X would be the athletes and a new Olympic village with 4,500 new apartments, privately financed, not paid for by any government subsidy. The only additional cost would be to the Olympics for occupying the space during that period of time and then converting it afterwards. We would move the athletes up and down the East River and create an entirely revived East River, and that would be north-south and east-west. We have a rail line that currently exists that goes into Penn Station and in the other direction out Long Island, and all of our venues are along the Olympic X and will be accessible to spectators by subway because most of them are also in walking distance of the subway. Our subway ridership goes down about 800,000 in the summertime. August is the low point in our hotel occupancy in New York, so the arrival of the Olympics allows us to do things that we could not otherwise do in the peak period around Thanksgiving or Christmas.
Now, all of this, I assume, plus constructing some of these venues, a lot of them, this would cost a lot of money. What's the projection in terms of how much the city might make?
Well, there are two different ways of doing this. The Olympics brings in money in the form of ticket sales, television rights, sponsorship. Once you deduct from that the money that's necessary to operate the Olympics, you have left about $1.2 billion to build the facilities that the city does not have. And we would be building a velodrome, an equestrian center, fixing existing facilities that require adjustments for the Olympics, and just using some that are well known to work well, like Yankee Stadium for baseball or the U.S. Tennis Center for tennis, so that we would have $1.2 billion in construction. In addition to that, we would probably have another $2.4 million of operating costs. And in fact, the Olympics itself are estimated to generate over the life of the period about $11 billion total spending. This includes the visitors at hotels and restaurants and so on, and about 136,000 person-year jobs. So this is a massive infusion of capital, but far more important than the spending and the jobs is the change that comes to a city when the Olympics come to town. We are seeing that now in Athens.
Well, Athens is advertising itself as a modern capital for the 21st century. Calgary wanted to put itself on the international map. Salt Lake City, the same. Atlanta wanted to be seen as the beacon of the New South. New York City, what does New York City need the Olympics?
We don't need the Olympics, but what the Olympics can do for New York and what New York can do for the Olympics is what the important story is. You know, there are more things that go on, more neighborhoods with more different ethnic groups. We have almost as many residents of New York whose native country is competing in the Olympics. We are the world's second home. We bring together those people. They live together in the spirit of friendship, just as the Olympics does when it brings the people to town. So what we're able to do is to provide a fan base that is simply not matched in any other city in the world.
Thanks very much for being with us.
You're more than welcome.
Alexander Garvin is Managing Director for Planning, Design, and Development for New York City 2012, the committee that's anchoring the Olympic bid, and he joined us on the phone from the city of New York. Let's go back to phone calls, and Marty is with us from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hello there.
Hi there.
I was one of the stagehands working inside the building during the Fleet Center event. It was a lot of fun. It was very exciting. Hello?
Yeah.
And there was quite an economic impact for those of us working locally. Part of what was interesting, having done many things like this, is I am sure the Democratic National Committee who sponsored it found our bill to be lower than we expected.
Really?
Much less overtime on that job than any of us expected. We made good money. I'm not complaining. Nobody's complaining. But we did not work the kinds of hours we thought we would because it was much better organized than most of those shows usually are.
So for you, was it worth it?
Absolutely. I do 30 to 50 events in that building every year. I've done Mick Jagger and all the other big groups. The stuff I'm saving is from the Democratic National Convention.
Marty, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Let's talk now with Jennifer. Jennifer is in Savannah, South Carolina.
No, Savannah, Georgia.
Savannah, Georgia. Please excuse me. I just read these things they put in front of me. Sometimes I'm really stupid. I apologize.
You see what happens when you get the G8, they don't even know what state you're in. What I wanted to ask about was how far out you have to go before you can really determine reasonably a value to your area. And especially with the G8,
Jennifer seems to have borrowed Mayor Menino's cell phone, but I think her question is, I think they had the G8 summit there in islands off the coast of Georgia, and she's saying how far out in the future do you have to go before you figure out whether you made any money or not, or whether those promised benefits of future tourism ever come to fruition. Haywood Sanders?
Well, in terms of tourism, we can track fairly readily how many hotel rooms were occupied and then compare that with what happened a year or 2 years previously, get some sense of what the real net gain is. The question of longer-term impacts on tourism is a rather more difficult one. Often, certainly, you'd want to look out a few years, but it even in the narrow case, it's we're talking in about tourism in a world in which tourism, travel are shaped by a great many other factors, the nature of the economic cycle, whether we're in the midst of a recession or a growth boom. And certainly these days, what should be abundantly clear to everybody in this country is that after September 11th, we've seen a dramatic change in folks' travel behavior. Hotel occupancies and hotel rates around the country plunged. Boston went from about 79% occupancy down to last year about 70%. Even with the DNC in town, Boston may get back up to about 73%, but they'll still be below where they were in 99 and 2000. It'll take a while for that kind of hotel activity to change. And so it's likely that the kind of impact that Mayor Menino talked about is going to be swamped, frankly, by the larger nature of changes in tourism and the national economy. But your caller from Savannah makes a point. The G8 come and the G8 go, and our image of Savannah and our likelihood of going there don't change a whole lot.
Whichever state we think it's in.
Indeed.
We're talking about the economics of cities hosting major events like political conventions, New York City next week, Boston last month, or the Olympic Games, Athens right now, and New York City maybe in 2012. And you're listening to The Conversation on Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Professor Andrew Zimbalist joins us now. He's an expert on the economics of sports at Smith College, the author most recently of May the Best Team Win, Baseball Economics and Public Policy. He's with us from his office there in Northampton, Massachusetts. Good of you to be with us.
Pleasure to talk to you, Neil.
We heard from Alexander Garvin all about the benefits to New York if it gets to host the 2012 Olympics. What are the risks of taking something of this size on?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure what benefits he enumerated, I'm not sure that there are very many in terms of benefiting the local economy. The risks are multiple. One of the risks we can discern by looking at what happened in Athens. When Athens was awarded the Olympic Games for this year many years back, their projected budget was $1.6 billion. They now think they're going to be spending somewhere between $9 and $12 billion. So there can be cost overruns. The cost overruns could have to do with the facilities themselves. They could have to do with infrastructure. They could have to do with security or other matters. So this certainly is one major risk. Another risk is the security itself and what kind of damage could be brought to the city's infrastructure. Another risk is what happens to the buildings after they're used, the facilities. Are all of the different sports venues going to be used productively in the future? And if they're not only used a little bit productively, but used on a regular basis, if they're not, then for a city like New York, you're using up very scarce and very valuable land for underused facilities that could be better put to use for park space, perhaps for commercial space, perhaps for residential space.
So why do cities continue to bid so ferociously for these events?
Well, I think what's primarily going on is that you have political interests and economic interests that are very strong, such as construction companies, development companies, contractors, architects, construction unions, investment bankers who are going to float the bonds that are needed to finance initially the construction, lawyers who are working with the investment bankers. There's a coterie of economic interests that tend to be very powerful in an urban political economy that get behind it, and they go to the mayor or they go to city council people and they say, here's what we want you to do, here's how we're going to support you if you support us, and they form a coalition. They go out and they hire some consulting firm or an accounting firm to do a bogus economic impact study, and they spend a lot of money promoting it. And so in the end, yes, a mega event will help certain firms in a city, but that's very different from helping the city economy overall.
Let's get another caller in. Doug joins us from Atlanta, Georgia.
That's right. Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Doug.
Hello.
Yes, Doug, you're on the air.
I hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. You're on the air, Doug. Go ahead,
okay.
Please.
Well, I'm a native Atlantan. I worked in the exhibit business before and after Atlanta hosted the Olympic Games in 96. And what I sort of experienced was in dealing with the sponsors who are sort of used to putting on large events and being well organized internally to handle the extra strain and expense and dealing with contractors in foreign cities or other cities in order to achieve their objectives, the city of Atlanta, although a big city, was so unprepared to handle various and sundry parts and, you know, simple things like training the bus drivers to be able to get people to the correct events without getting lost,
mm-hmm.
that the cities themselves, I think, sort of need to have a school to go to if they intend to host these things so that they, one, do a good job, and the other is they have such a, I think, a responsibility to the people that live there full time to deal with the infrastructure problems that are already there in most big cities, instead of putting a lot of sort of glitz on top of what's already there.
Mm-hmm.
Spend the money intelligently, in other words.
Well, thanks, Doug, very much for the phone call. And we'll get reactions to that phone call and other thoughts when we come back from a short break. We're talking with Haywood Sanders of the University of Texas at San Antonio and with Andrew Zimbalist, a professor of economics at Smith College, about the economics of big events. Cities host them all the time. We're also going to talk after the break about why Iraqis risk their lives to bury their loved ones in the embattled city of Najaf. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, we'll be talking with one of the authors of the first in a series of reports on the prison abuse scandal at Abu Ghraib in Iraq. That's this hour tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation on the economics of big events in major cities. Haywood Sanders, the professor of economics at the University of Texas at San Antonio, is with us. Also joining us is Andrew Zimbalist, a professor of economics at Smith College. He's the author of May the Best Team Win, Baseball Economics and Public Policy. Let's get another caller on the line, and Derek joins us from Salt Lake City.
Yeah, I was just giving you a call in to tell you about the Olympics in 02, and it kind of actually drew me into Salt Lake City and made me decide to come to college even here in Salt Lake City, because we built new dorms and the new roads and everything. It's a lot easier to get around and not a lot nicer place to live even.
Wanted to get both of your takes on this. Before the break, we heard from a caller from Atlanta said the Olympics didn't help that city's image much, especially when the drivers couldn't get their passengers to the right venues on time. And we've had a couple of calls, not only Derek, but other people calling from Salt Lake City to say, hey, they did things pretty well here. Things worked out all right. Why don't we begin with you, Haywood Sanders?
Well, a large part of it involves the planning beforehand, and in many cases, the thing that isn't planned for, and that's the plan for after. Atlanta did a number of things, Centennial Olympic Park, for example, that gave it some open space, got rid of some older, perhaps blighted buildings, but didn't necessarily change the fabric of the inner city. In fact, the promise to inner city Atlanta neighborhoods that they would receive significant improvement and upgrading never was realized. In Salt Lake City's case, some investment in infrastructure can make a difference for the folks who live there or folks who might be attracted there. That is a real positive that we tend to see from the Olympics, although, as Andrew Zimbalist has argued, a whole lot of that is benefit to the folks we call the local construction coalition, the folks who make their money out of building things. But the bottom line here is planning for something after, and how are you going to use it, and what kind of role is it going to play in the urban fabric? When Alexander Garvin was speaking a few minutes ago about New York, my mind flashed back to Flushing Meadows, the site of the 1939 and then 1964 World's Fairs in New York. It's still there, still parkland, and still with some decaying pavilions that really don't amount to much in terms of public use.
Everybody who's been to the movies knows that that thing is really an alien spaceship. That's what it's used for.
Andrew, Neil, you know, I think the other point that has to be made here is that the investment in infrastructure is local money, and the investment in buildings is local money. If they think that they need to improve their road system, then they should invest local money in improving their road system. You don't have to have the Olympics. They don't get any of the NBC money to improve their local roads. You don't need the Olympics to do that.
Yeah, but some Olympics do work out pretty well.
Well, I think that the record will show that probably only the Los Angeles Olympics has generated a clear surplus. The analyses that I've seen of other recent Olympic events show either a deficit or a break-even situation fiscally.
Okay. Thank you both very much for being with us. Derek, by the way, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
Okay, appreciate it. And let's say goodbye now to Andrew Zimbalist. We appreciate your time today.
My pleasure, Neil.
Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College, and also to Haywood Sanders. Thank you so much.
Nice to join you. A pleasure.
Haywood Sanders was with us from the studios of member station KSTX, Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. And an email before we leave this subject from a listener trying to make me feel a little better for my gaffe. Don't feel so bad, writes Joe Evans. There is a Savannah, South Carolina. It's near the intersection of Interstates 20 and 85, about 70 miles northeast of Myrtle Beach. Maybe someday we'll get a call from there.